In the coming week, U.S. health officials discuss emergency authorization of a COVID-19 vaccine. Venezuelans vote for a new National Assembly, the country's last opposition-controlled body. And the U.S. nears a December 8th safe harbor election deadline. It's December 3rd, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, we now have several companies that have come forward in recent weeks with potential COVID-19 vaccines. And the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is set to meet to discuss potential emergency authorization of vaccines. This happens while case numbers, hospitalizations, and daily death tolls from the virus reach their highest levels in the United States and continue to expand worldwide. So tell us more about this highly anticipated meeting, Jim.
This is a big meeting, Bob, because it may signal that we are finally turning the corner in containing the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the FDA is convening what's called the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, which goes by the acronym of the VRBPAC. And what it's going to be doing next Thursday, December 10th, is assessing Pfizer's request for emergency use authorization for a vaccine candidate. The committee is going to meet the following week on December 17th to discuss the candidate vaccine that has been developed by Moderna. Now, both vaccines in their trial have shown effectiveness rates of greater than 90%. So that's the good news. Now, some people may know that the United Kingdom has already given its approval to the Pfizer vaccine. Now, the UK has a different process for reviewing vaccines. It relies essentially on the data the company presents, whereas in the United States, you have this committee, the VRBPAC, its job is to sort of step in and provide an independent assessment of the data generated by the company. And it's especially important in this case with emergency use because you're sort of compressing all the normal timelines for developing the medicine. And so the VRBPAC is composed of outside experts, no ties to the company, and they go through and review the data. And that's what they'll be doing. Now, the expectation is that the VRBPAC is going to give Pfizer the thumbs up and going to give the thumbs up subsequently to Moderna, in which case we'll then begin distributing the vaccine. Now, the distribution could begin within 24 hours, in the case of the Pfizer vaccine, of getting sort of the thumbs up from the FDA. A number of the Pfizer vaccines have already been pre-positioned around the country, and it's anticipated that by the end of the year, between Pfizer and Moderna, we could have something on the order of 40 million doses having been produced. Now, I want to be very careful here. That doesn't mean that there will be 40 million people who can be vaccinated. Both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines require two shots. So if you have 40 million doses, you can vaccinate something in the order of 20 million people. And I'll note in the case of Pfizer, you're supposed to take the first shot, wait 3 weeks, get the second shot. In the case of Moderna, you take the first shot, you wait 4 weeks and get the second shot. That then gets you in the question, who's going to get the vaccines first? We're probably talking about frontline healthcare workers, followed by elderly people who live in group care facilities. That makes sense given that hospitals right now are swamped with COVID-19 cases, and they can't afford to have their personnel being sick. And obviously, the elderly are the greatest at-risk group. Now, as vaccine production ramps up in early 2021, they'll sort of expand the net of people who can become vaccinated. We're probably looking in midwinter to the vaccination of essential workers, other people besides the elderly who are at risk. By the time you get to the spring, a broader population can be brought about. The head of Operation Warp Speed said last week that if everything goes well, by the time we get to May, we could have as much as 70% of the American public vaccinated on COVID-19, thereby possibly providing herd immunity, which would make it more difficult for the vaccine to spread. Now, of course, what he said was if everything goes well, and there are lots of ways in which this could go off the rocks, one of the, in essence, being the question of how quickly will Americans take up the vaccine. I want to emphasize, Bob, that there are a couple of things we don't know. One, we don't know how long the protection provided by the vaccine will last. We also don't know whether vaccinated people will be infectious. Again, because when they tested the vaccine, they weren't looking to see if people who contracted it could pass it on to other people. And finally, there's this issue of anti-vaxxer sentiment and to what extent that may dissuade people from getting shots.
Well, I saw a report today, Jim, about three former U.S. presidents announcing they were willing willing to go on live TV and show themselves being vaccinated as a way of trying to instill some confidence.
And that's very good. And we're going to need other sort of steps like that, Bob. But as we also know, stories of potential adverse reactions to vaccine shots, whether true or not, can really get amplified on social media. And people could be worried because when they hear this vaccine was developed very quickly and they hear a story, again, whether real or fake, that there was an adverse reaction, could cause people to step back and say, hey, I am going to wait. And then, of course, you also have the problem that to the extent we continue with two-shot vaccines, what percentage of the population will get the first shot, but for whatever reason, never getting around to getting the second shot, either because they forget or when they show up, the second shot's not available, you know, their schedules don't mesh and the like. So there's a lot of friction in the system for doing this. And we don't know how it's going to work out. That being said, looking at it against the backdrop of more than 2,000 people a day dying in the United States from COVID-19, the work on the vaccines is a really bright spot that tells us that perhaps we are at the beginning of the end.
Jim, I had one quick follow-up question on the logistics. So you mentioned the UK rolling out the vaccine next week and having a different sort of set of issues and protocols to follow. One big difference being that it's a nationalized approach that the UK can take, whereas the US, my understanding is that once federal authorities weigh in, it then becomes a state-run matter. Do you know, is it the fact that the states will then say, okay, the healthcare workers in California, you know, line up, or you in Virginia, or you in New York, is it devolves to the state health authorities from that point onward? And then we look to them to kind of help set this whole thing in play?
Yes. I mean, there's a delicate federal-state coordination role going on here. And again, we have to give credit to the Trump administration, which struck deals early on with the vaccine companies and is going to be buying vast quantities of these vaccines that will be distributed. Now, where will people be getting the vaccine? It's not like from the movies where, you know, the army shows up and sets up tents and people stand in line and get shot. The way it's going to work when they roll it out more broadly is that in theory, people will be able to go to their healthcare provider or their local CVS or Walgreens or Duane Reade and get a shot. And as part of that, what they're trying to set up is a national database that's going to track who gets what shot when. So you can deal with issues. Let's say somebody is eligible to get the vaccine. They live in New York. It's January. They get the first shot. But in February, when they should be getting the second shot, they're in Florida. How do you make sure they get the right shot? Because again, you don't want somebody getting the Pfizer shot the first time around and the Moderna shot the second time around. So the idea is to create a database that will allow all of these issues to be settled or resolved quickly. How well that works, I don't know. It's a pretty heavy lift to make sure all of those parts work. So we'll see how it all plays out. But clearly, there's going to have to be an awful lot of coordination between the federal government, state government, private providers. And because you have to have that coordination, that's an obvious place where the system could break down and not produce the kind of results that the head of Operation Warp Speed was predicting in his if everything goes well scenario.
But still in all, the speed in which this is moving forward now is approaching breathtaking. And obviously everybody's hoping for the best. And you can't stress enough how much and how hard these people are working to try to make this happen.
Quite true, Bob. And I should note one thing we haven't talked about is, of course, going to be how to distribute this vaccine and other vaccines more broadly around the world. There's still that issue of vaccine nationalism. This is going to be a big issue for the Biden administration when it comes into office. What do you do? Because obviously what you want to provide vaccines to others who don't have their own indigenous technological capacity to produce the vaccines, but at the same time, you have an obligation to your own citizens. Now, I should also note there are other candidate vaccines around the world that are being ramped up could go into production that will also contribute it. But there is an international dimension to this problem that is quite significant. Bob, let's turn our attention to an election that's taking place this Sunday in Venezuela. Venezuelans are going to have an opportunity to vote on membership in the Venezuelan National Assembly, which is the only institution left controlled by Venezuela's opposition. The Maduro regime is hoping that this vote is going to undercut the opposition and essentially demolish the shadow government led by Juan Guaido. So set the scene for us, Bob, how you think this is all going to play out.
It's a big undertaking, as all general general elections have been in the era of COVID, but few countries can be as beleaguered as Venezuela even before the pandemic hit. So you're going to have a country that many have called a near fail state going forward with this major nationwide initiative to elect 277 deputies, which is 111 more than the previous National Assembly that was elected 5 years ago. As you said, this National Assembly is the only national level institution that the opposition controls. The country has had a bit of a shadow government going on where the National Assembly has chosen opposition leader Juan Guaido as the leader, saying that the national elections for leader that brought Nicolas Maduro to power were illegitimate. Something like 50 countries, including the United States and many European countries, as well as major democracies in Latin America, recognize Guaido as Venezuela's leader, but Nicolas Maduro controls the levers of power for the most part, security organizations, the levers of the major revenue producing oil industry and so forth. And so he is a de facto leader. This election looks to be heavily controlled by the government, which has sway over the election commission, also has sway, by the way, over the judiciary. It holds the means with which to influence these elections in a way that are supposed to deliver a resounding popular mandate for Nicolas Maduro. It remains to be seen. There is going to be competition, but as many reports have noted in recent weeks, the opposition itself is divided over the extent to which it should participate in the election. European countries, by the way, had pressed Venezuela to delay the vote for another 6 months or so, saying it couldn't really hold a legitimate vote at this time. The government has said, no, the Constitution requires it. We have to hold this vote, so we're going to go forward with it. And so you have allies of Mr. Guaido are saying, well, we're not going to take part in this. We'll hold our own online sort of referendum against the government instead. Other opposition groups have said, no, it's we should take part and you know use this opportunity, as flawed as it is, to voice our views about the government. Again, little has changed in terms of the way the power structures around Maduro have led Venezuela. It has been a catastrophe. Even pre-pandemic, you had something like 5 million people flee the country, which marks the biggest outflow of people in South America's modern history. And what it has brought has been sort of international opprobrium and so forth. However, Maduro holds on, and he has sort of defied many predictions that he would be crushed under the weight of opposition boycotts of sanctions by the U.S., for example. And so, again, we're anticipating an election that will bring the National Assembly under the sway of Maduro's, under what they call the Chavismo elements in Venezuela. But it's not clear whether or not this is going to create some sort of other crisis atmosphere in the country or not.
So, Bob, why has Maduro been able to hold on, given the obvious fact that he has mismanaged Venezuela's economy, driven it into the ground?
It's a good point. I mean, he's, for one thing, his persistent tactic, which though it's been repeated almost ad nauseum, seems to have worked, has been to demonize outside forces, and particularly the United States, as this malign force that is not acting in the interests of Venezuelans, and particularly of the elites that are around him in Venezuela. And so he's been able to play that card. He also has some powerful outside friends, you know, China and Russia, illiberal democracies such as Turkey also have been willing to go around the embargoes. Iran is a friend as well. So Venezuela has been able to line up countries outside that can help bring the sort of the ruling power centers the resources they need to continue to function. And they muddle along. It does, again, having seen many reports on this and many predictions about the anticipated demise of Maduro-led Venezuela, it does seem to be mystifying how he's able to retain power. And it's not, even though that, again, as I said, the government does seem to hold sway over the levers of influence and power for these elections, it's not a foregone conclusion that he then retains a rock-hard grip on the country. It could send into some sort of spiral, some sort of further dissension and division within the country. So it remains to be seen what Venezuela's near future is going to be like, Jim. Jim, I'm going to stay in the hemisphere and actually on the theme of elections to continue to cite our own presidential elections here in the U.S., which will play out on another stage. This week, Americans will mark the so-called safe harbor election deadline. That's the date in which presidential election results must be finalized. December 8th is not maybe as easily marked on the calendar as November 3rd, which is election day, or January 20th, which is inauguration day. But Jim, what do we need to know about the safe harbor day, and why is it a date we should keep an eye on?
Well, Bob, you're quite right that Safe Harbor Day is an obscure day in our electoral calendar.
But we've been getting quite a civics lesson this year, I guess, on all sorts
of things. We certainly are. I mean, I got to tell you, I'm a policy wonk. And even as a policy wonk, I don't pay much attention to the Safe Harbor deadline because there's normally no need to. But again, 2020 is a very different animal. It's different not just because President Trump has refused to concede, but also because he's actively looking for ways to try to overturn election results. Now, when you talk about the Safe Harbor deadline, deadline. In theory, what it means is if a state has certified its election results by that day, those election results are immune from legal challenge. And it's sometimes said they are also immune from further congressional challenge. The latter isn't quite true. And that fact has given some hope to some diehard Trump supporters that there is still a path to President Trump's reelection victory. Now, keep in mind that the Electoral College is going to convene on December 14th. We anticipate the outcome is going to be 306 to 232, assuming there are no faithless electors who vote for a different candidate.
And you might happened in some small ways, right?
Happened in some small ways, but not enough to change the outcome. And obviously, when you have 306 to 232, you'd have to have wholesale changes never seen in American history to reverse the vote. So again, we expect on December 14th, the Electoral College will vote for Joe Biden. And you might think that everything is done. That's the final step. It's all over. But it's not. The last step in our electoral process is that Congress convenes on January 6th at 1 p.m. in a joint session to certify the results. Congress goes state by state, and the process is normally ceremonial and perfunctory. However, and this is what's giving hope to some Trump supporters, federal law stipulates that if at least one member of the House and one member of the Senate rises to object to a state's set of electors, then the House and Senate each have to retire separately, convene separately, to assess the claim, 2 hours to do it, and then hold a vote on the merits of that claim. So what we have now is, given that we have this sort of provision in our electoral law, and this is a federal law that goes back, I think, to 1887, so the Electoral Count Act, and what they see is an opportunity to challenge a state's electors, and obviously they would challenge a state in which Joe Biden won, presumably states in which he won narrowly. And Trump supporters who are talking about this say, quite rightly, that in the last 2 decades, there have been 3 occasions when Democratic House members rose during this essentially ceremonial event to object to a state's results and to try to throw it into a broader debate and discussion. Most recently, that happened in 2016. And it came as a bit of irony for us because at the time, the sitting vice president was Joe Biden. And for the purposes of certifying electoral results, law states that the sitting vice president chairs the meeting, presides over it. So you had Democratic House lawmakers trying to object to votes as they came in, and Joe Biden standing up and telling them that, hey, it's over, and saying it to the applause of Republican members. So we'll see what happens come January. 2020 certainly is different, again, in having a losing candidate that won't concede. It may even be encouraging lawmakers to sort of go through these last-ditch efforts. They're highly unlikely to succeed, but at a minimum, I think people should be prepared for a possible final flurry of political theater for a very unusual 2020 campaign.
And meanwhile, playing out in various states according to the various states' laws are challenges that are taken up in both legislatures in some cases or in courts, in federal courts. Is that right, Jim?
Yeah, almost all of those have been exhausted because the vast majority of states have already certified their votes. They've gotten them in, so that is settled. I'll say one thing that's very clear if we look at the election results from 2020 is just how close the vote was. In fact, 2020 was an even closer race than 2016 was. Even though Joe Biden more than doubled Hillary Clinton's popular vote lead. You may recall back in 2016 that if Hillary Clinton had picked up 78,000 votes in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, she would have won the presidency. By contrast, in 2020, if Trump had picked up 65,000 votes in 3 states, Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin, and had he won the Nebraska 2nd Congressional District, because Nebraska, like Maine, doesn't give all of its votes just based on winning the state, he would have won outright. And if Trump had picked up roughly 44,000 votes in those 3 states, Arizona, Georgia, and Wisconsin, we would have had a tie in the Electoral College, 269 to 269, which would have thrown the election decision to the House of Representatives, which almost certainly would have voted to make Trump president. So this was, again, a very close election, even though in terms of the popular vote, it was a pretty substantial win for Joe Biden.
And we should also note, again, that you've now had the top U.S. cybersecurity official, who is also recently fired, but he came in and said these elections were free and fair, and we were able to conduct a safe election free of fraud. You have the U.S. Attorney General saying he so far has not found any meaningful cases of fraud in these elections as well. And those were statements made very much in defiance of the president's own almost daily statements, tweets, and so forth, that there was rampant fraud. So it does seem that if you go from the local officials on up to the federal level, you're not seeing any sort of credible case that's being made for, despite the closeness, any sort of fraudulence involved in those numbers.
Yeah, I think it's very clear that we had a clean and fair count. Bob, we've come to the time in the show when we talk about our figures of the week. Let's start with our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected Iranian scientists killed. Tell us why, Bob.
Well, we came into the week after hearing about the targeted killing, by all accounts, of a man reported to be Iran's top nuclear scientist, or the father of Iranian nuclear science in some accounts, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, I think is the way you pronounce it. He was killed on a highway outside of Tehran. I have seen multiple versions of it, but it was a number of shots fired. Whether or not it was some sort of automatically generated firing or there were humans involved, it stands up as first of all, a major breach of Iranian security. That Iran has already dealt with in recent years, killings of other scientists and other incidents involving attacks or theft involving its nuclear program. So here you have a very high profile figure being killed. It created all sorts of recriminations within Iran, in addition to outrage expressed publicly and major officials linking it to Israeli forces. It also has triggered comments about internal investigations and how such a thing could happen. So there's a variety of things going on here, Jim. There is questions about the state of security within the regime, which has always seemed to be sort of an ironclad. If nothing else, it seemed to run a pretty rigorous security ship in the last 40 years. But also the timing of the attack, if indeed it was Israeli forces, and if or not they were abetted by the U.S. government, you know, what does this mean for the state of U.S.-Iranian affairs and the potential for any sort of nuclear diplomacy with an incoming Biden administration? And President-elect Joe Biden has talked about re-entering the Iran nuclear deal if Iran goes back to abiding in full by the agreement, some sort of return to the status quo and potentially further talks, it's not clear, but at least at the very least, a return to status quo in that relationship. That's kind of up in the air at this point. You've had a move by the Iranian parliament this week to not allow any further UN inspections because despite Iran sort of ramping up its nuclear activities, they have continued to allow the UN nuclear agency to come and make inspections. So Iran's president, Rouhani, does not want to close off Iran to the UN inspections, but there's now a power struggle taking place in which the hardliners seem to hold the upper hand. So it's a very sort of tumultuous period we're looking at yet again in Iran and vis-a-vis U.S.-Iran relations.
You're quite right, Bob. It's going to be tumultuous. And it suggests that the Biden administration is going to face a very big foreign policy test very early in its term. I'll note that the Iranian parliament passed a bill authorizing the government to enrich its uranium up to 20%. That's the maximum they reached before the 2015 Iran nuclear deal was put in place. And that is going to sort of essentially be the death knell of the agreement, unless the Biden administration somehow can persuade the Iranians to take a step back. And the question is, what would the Biden administration be willing to offer the Iranians? And that itself is politically and diplomatically fraught. If you begin with the political problem here at home, it clearly is going to be a lot of pushback if the administration is seen as offering a sizable olive branch to the Iranians. And that criticism will not just come from Republicans, but I think also from a lot of Democrats. But the Biden administration is also looking at the possibility that Iran could decide to up the ante and make a dash for a nuclear weapon or get closer to a nuclear weapon. Remember, the whole point of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal was to widen or lengthen that breakout time. The talk was the deal had meant it would take Iran as much as a year to be able to build a nuclear weapon. I think by everyone's calculations right now, we're talking down just a couple of months given recent developments. And if you go up to 20% enriched uranium, that breakout window shrinks even more. So the Biden administration is going to come into office, lots on the domestic front, lots on the foreign policy front, and Iran could sort of be pushing its way to the top of that pile.
And thanks to our audience for picking another very timely figure of the week. Jim, what about you? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, I'm going with a number as my figure of the week, and it is 908, as in 908 billion. This Tuesday, a bipartisan group of lawmakers on Capitol Hill announced their proposal for a new COVID-19 stimulus plan. It nets out at 908 billion. Obviously, this has been a big issue in Washington that has sort of gone nowhere for months. Most people, certainly the head of the Federal Reserve, thinks that the U.S. economy is potentially slowing down, that some stimulus is needed, particularly efforts to help people who have lost their jobs or whose jobs are at risk because of the pandemic. You may recall earlier on, we had the stimulus bill that allowed much longer unemployment insurance. Those plans have all run out, and there's just been a real sort of gridlock on Capitol Hill on moving forward. Democrats want to spend as much as $3 trillion. Many Republicans not willing to go above $1 trillion, if that. To a considerable extent, the Trump administration has been sitting a lot of this out. And this effort by this bipartisan group of lawmakers is a sign that potentially you might be able to get some bill done quickly. President-elect Joe Biden has made it very clear that he would like to see Congress and the Trump administration pass some kind of stimulus bill. He's worried, not unreasonably, that if action is not taken now, that we could see a real steep economic downturn early in 2021. Can't imagine any president wants to come into the White House seeing a decline in the economy, so they have an incentive to get things done. But again, the fact that something should get done, there's a fair amount of support for getting something done, doesn't mean in Washington that something will get done. And I should just note, as we're talking about this stimulus package, we still have the problem of getting Congress in the White House to agree on funding the government going forward. And the deadline for that is December 11th. We'll see if something can get worked out. Betting money is something will get worked out. It generally does get worked out. And then it's in no one's interest to have a government shutdown. Keep in mind, we're trying to do things like roll out a vaccine to protect Americans from the coronavirus. So you wouldn't want to have government shutting down. But that said, the most likely way to resolve that issue is to sort of push the issue of funding government sometime in the 2021, which means that it will now become a President Biden's issue to handle and raises a whole host of challenges for the incoming administration, which obviously would like to get to work on implementing its plans for rebuilding America, getting the economy running, not getting mired in a dogfight early on about funding the government for what at that point will be about 6 or 7 months.
Yeah, Jim, as you mentioned these figures, it's undeniable. It does seem like the country needs this boost at this moment. And there's a lot of people really hurting. And we're, by all accounts, facing an extremely challenging winter in which lockdown efforts are going to be even more severe.
Right.
But the numbers are just, they're getting so high, it's almost reaching a level of just hard to fathom. And whether or not it's only 900 billion or it crosses a $1 trillion mark again, it's a whole other area of reckoning in terms of how the U.S. is going to be able to dig out of its debt. But I think, you know, job one seems to be among a number of legislators from both parties is to try to do something now.
Again, Bob, the reality is that the economic impact of COVID-19 has not been felt evenly across the country. People like ourselves, so-called knowledge workers, have been able to do reasonably well. We have the ability to work remotely, have Zoom meetings and the like. But for many Americans, it is simply impossible to do that. And again, if you work in the hotel industry, airline industry, restaurant industry, recreational industry, you have been heavily hit by this, and those people are hurting. And hopefully government will be able to get something pulled together shortly to be able to help those people, because again, people are really hurting.
Indeed.
But what about you, Bob? What is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a person, or shall I say it is a person named John Doe, or shall I say it is six people named John Doe. And what I'm referring to are six adult citizens of Mali, who are referred only as John Does, who had a case that came before the U.S. Supreme Court this week involving a period of time more than 15 years ago when they say as children, they were forced into essentially slave labor on farms in which cocoa was harvested for major U.S.-based chocolate producers. The case concerns this U.S. law called the Alien Tort Statute. It's a 1789 law, and it lets non-U.S. citizens seek damages in U.S. courts in some instances. And so they are targeting the U.S. subsidiary of Nestle, which is a Swiss-based company, as well as Cargill, a very large privately held U.S. company. And basically, they're saying these companies aided and abetted human rights violations as part of their involvement in purchasing Ivory Coast cocoa at lower prices and sort of allowing slave labor practices to play out. The companies vehemently deny this and don't want this case to move forward. And they basically are saying they were not aware of these types of practices and could not be seen as abetting that practice. So there's the case itself involving these six individuals, but there's also, it's being closely watched for ramifications for other human rights violations or cases that could be brought for companies based in the U.S. in a whole host of other instances. It is, in addition to the six, it is a sort of, it's a class action lawsuit that the six are saying really represents thousands of other former child slaves.
I know, Bob, on a lot of big Supreme Court cases, the issue tends to break along partisan lines. Do we have any sense that that's the case here, or is this one of those cases that really doesn't sort of fit that simple model of Republican justice opposed to Democratic justices?
Well, I should note, first of all, that a decision is not expected until June. And so what people have to go on are the comments made by justices of conservative or liberal leanings. And what was interesting in this case, going by the questions asked by justices, was that you had both liberal and conservative justices asking questions that were seen to be challenging arguments made by the attorney for Cargill and Nestle. But by the same token, they also challenged some of the assertions made by the attorney for the plaintiffs. It's a bit of a mixed bag. Rulings in the past have indicated, you know, that it would be a possible reach for this court now, which has a majority of conservatives, to rule against the two U.S. companies. But, you know, you don't want to just sort of prejudge it either, Jim. So it's hard to say at this point.
So they've held the hearing, but we're not likely to hear for quite a while.
That's right. Now it's just sort of taking stock of the arguments, the questions, parsing it out, and sort of waiting now, cooling our heels for 6 months.
Okay, so then we have to commit ourselves when the decision is rendered to talking about the end result here on The World Next Week.
Yes, mark that on your calendars now. We are committed to circling back on this.
Fair enough.
And that's our look at The World Next Week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. General elections will take place in Ghana and Kuwait, and Ukraine marks Armed Forces Day.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge, Cara Jackson, and Kendall Ross for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collins. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.